Please be seated. I used to cross the Norris Bridge that connects the Middle Peninsula with the Northern Neck all the time. Where the bridge goes across the Rappahannock River, the water is more than a mile across. It's hard to take a good look when you're driving across the bridge, but even a quick glance is breathtaking. To the west, the river stays broad into the distance. To the east, the wide river flows out into the great Chesapeake Bay and beyond. If you were to trace the river west, let's just say that you can hover above the water, moving west, it would still be broad, a mile across when you come to the crossing at Tappahannock. Further west as you go on, the river stays broad until it suddenly narrows just east of Port Royal near the fall line below Fredericksburg. And at this point, the ocean tide ceases to influence the rise and the fall of the river, and the water finally becomes entirely fresh for the first time. Traveling still further west, you arrive at a branching where the Rappahannock goes on to the north and the Rapidan flows off to the south. And into the hilly country still further west, the Rappahannock narrows more past Culpeper and runs northwest till it plunges into the mountains south of Front Royal. Somewhere below Chester Gap, in the shadow of Mount Marshall's 3,368-foot peak, the Rappahannock contracts from a hurrying river into a narrower stream to a racing creek till it arrives at its mysterious spring and source. In all, the river runs 184 miles from a spring breaking out mysteriously in a mountain to the broad ocean-like mouth near the bridge at Whitestone. One day, when I was stopped atop 110 feet above the river's surface for road work, I was looking off west and I had a funny kind of thought. I thought, what if you could find your way to the source, where the original spring breaks clear of the earth and begins to flow out? And what if, I'm telling you, it was a strange thought, and what if a leaf dropped on that clear surface? For all we know, it just happened. Could that leaf make it all the way to the bay? Seems unlikely, doesn't it? Too many obstacles along the way. It would just have to get lost somewhere along the way, right? But stranger things have happened. Consider this. On one particular day long ago, Jesus of Nazareth opened his mouth and said for the very first time, "There was a man who had two sons." There was a day when Jesus first spoke those words, and it was first heard for the very first time, and the story began its journey through the mercy of God to us this morning who just heard it, so far away. It is the third of a trio of stories Jesus tells, one after another, to a group of Pharisees and scribes who were upset with Jesus because they said of him, "This man receives sinners and eats with them." Their point was that these people whom Jesus was dining with weren't just nice people who were misunderstood. Some of them were people working for a foreign government collecting taxes from their neighbors and making good money doing it. The others were people who had made a mess of their lives, and there were some serious amends that needed to be made first before dinner invitations could be sent out. There is a difference between right and wrong, yes? And it looks a whole lot like Jesus is condoning bad behavior. But Jesus doesn't counter their argument with an argument of his own. He tells them three stories about a lost sheep, a lost coin, a lost son. And this last story, as much as anything Jesus ever said, has been the one that people like us have held on to for dear life when it seemed like there was nothing else to hold on to. Maybe our stories aren't as dramatic as the younger son's story, but we all get lost. It's a story that tells us as clearly as anything Jesus ever said who his Father is, his character, his nature, his being. When Jesus tells us this story, he is leading us back upstream to the source of his life and ours. Our God, whose property it is always to have mercy. This story is a treasure we've been given to live our lives through and from. I want to revisit a story that I expect I've told you, I don't know, that happened going on 20 years ago. It is the story of a 10-year-old boy and his 15-year-old half-sister who I was preparing for baptism. They were new to the neighborhood and they were brand new to the church. She was a refugee from Liberia whose name is Ethel. And he was a refugee from a Liberian father living in New York City and a Senegalese mother living in Philadelphia, neither of whom apparently wanted him. And his name is Kay. And I met them after school in the church, and we gathered around this huge marble font. It was a beautiful day, and the sun streaming in through the stained glass windows. You could see on your arms in the air turn things amber and blue and green and gold. I told them to take out their prayer books and open to page 299, and I told them that we were going to talk about the meaning of baptism. Kay blurted, he was a great blurter, "You're going to tell us about Jesus, right? And then you're going to baptize me, right?" So I thought about the definition of a sacrament, as the church teaches it, and the ways I usually talk about baptism, how the world is not the way that God means for it to be, and neither are we. But something else occurred to me, so I said, "Close your prayer books." I knew something of each of their stories. They already knew that the world is not the way it's supposed to be. And where questions of right and wrong and who's at fault and who should we blame and all of that gets all jumbled up. Ethel had lived in the mountains of Liberia for months when she was a little girl during the Civil War there, hiding from armed men who roamed the countryside killing indiscriminately. And Kay had spent nights on the streets of New York City when he was 6 years old, searching for his father and wondering what he had done wrong. I decided I didn't want to talk about the church's teaching on baptism. So I said, "Okay, I want to tell you a story. There once was a man who had two sons." And then Kay blurted out, "I know this. The younger son took the father's money and he left home, right?" "Right. You tell him, Ethel," he said. Ethel, who was a very quiet girl, said, "And he spent it all in a far country in dissolute living." I said, "You know this story." She said, yes, we had church when I was little sometimes, and I remember hearing it. What happened to the son, I asked. He ate with the pigs, Kay exploded with laughter, and Ethel began to laugh. And so we told the story together, how the younger son finally came home, but before he could even get there, his father ran out and caught him in his arms, and then threw him a party to end all parties. And about the older son who refused to come to the party because he couldn't see past his own sense that he had been wronged. But what I remember most is how much they laughed. How could they laugh so much with the lives they had lived? How could these two little leaves have made it so far downstream, through so much? And come to the wide, deep waters of the baptism they were to receive the following week, surrounded by people who claimed them as their own. It can only be because these two, who knew so much about being lost, had already been found. The father had already run out to greet them too, on their way back from a far country. The grace of God got there first. God's grace had already happened, which is part of our problem with this most famous of Jesus' parables. Grace has already happened. The father is too glad to have a son back to worry about anything else. It is too late for arguments about what is right and what is wrong and what is fair. God's grace has already been given, because it is the property of God to always have mercy. Always. The father says to the elder son, "Son, you are always with me, and all that is mine is yours. It was fitting to make merry and be glad, because this brother of yours was dead and is alive. He was lost and is found." And then it seems like to me that something is missing in this story. The story ends there, but it ends with me, at least, wondering what the elder son will say of his father's mercy for his younger brother. We are left looking at the elder son, wondering, what will he say? Which is the position of the church? This is the place, in light of God's mercy, where we will proclaim good news or not. What will we say of the mercy of God that has already happened? Is it fair or is it gracious? We are making our way in these last Sundays of Lent, following Jesus and his way of the cross, back upstream to the source of our lives, where God's perfect mercy breaks through into the world. And we will make our way with him, or at least as long as our hearts will hold, to the place where he will plant his cross in the earth and lay down his life for the sin of the world. And so, listen. God's mercy has already been given, and forgiveness for you. So, if in your life what happened was bad, maybe even awful, whether it was something you did or something that somehow lies past blame and fault, whether you are the younger son or the elder son, God has already overcome the past by his forgiveness. So forget it and move on. Move on. So, here's something to think about. What about that little leaf that fell into the source of the river when this sermon started. It might have. I wonder where it is by now. Imagine this. Through the mercy of God, in the ways of grace, it is already floating under the big bridge at Whitestone, on its way to the great Chesapeake Bay and beyond. Amen.